Hello and welcome back to the How to Be Good podcast, the show where we interview people and businesses that are looking to combat the climate change and live a more sustainable life. I'm Gareth and with me is Anka.
Hi everyone. Today we have an air pollution scientist who has written a book. The book is called Beyond Debate.
Certainly worth a read.
It definitely is. It's a really good book and you can learn a lot from it. He is also running a project in the States called On the Road for Climate Action, educating people on climate action.
That's right. He's nearly been across the whole of the States. I think he's got 15 or so left that he's looking to do once we, I guess, are a little bit more free from the pandemic.
Let's welcome Shahir Masri.
Let's get on with the show.
Hello and welcome to the How to Be Good podcast. I'm here with Dr. Shahir Masri, climate scientist based out in California. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Really good. Really good. Thank you so much for joining us. I know this is our second attempt as we had a couple of technical issues last time, and it's very appreciated that you took the time to join us again.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Fantastic. So could you sort of tell us, I guess, your story? How did you become such a passionate climate scientist?
Sure. So I should step back and clarify. Technically, I'm an air pollution scientist. Most people don't distinguish, but I got into the field of air pollution basically as an undergraduate in college. I always found environmental health interesting, chemical exposure interesting. Of all the core sciences that I studied, chemistry was really the most fascinating to me. And it was only kind of natural as someone who cares about the environment. And I can actually go a little further back to, but just to finish, it was sort of natural as someone who cares about the environment and finds chemistry interesting. And also, I should say, my mother is a science teacher. So kind of having that background, environmental health, that is looking at chemical exposures, sort of was a natural place for me to kind of pursue graduate school. And that's probably the later in life place to start. It actually goes back though much earlier. So as I mentioned, my mother is an environmental science teacher at the high school level. She was always sort of getting us into the outdoors, kind of instilling it in us the importance of preserving the environment and, you know, starting out with certain things just like recycling and not littering and kind of your basic, environmental stewardship. But I think getting out in the outdoors, camping and ultimately later backpacking and rock climbing and surfing and sort of all these outdoor activities just really gave me an up close personal experience and exposure to the environment. It's hard to, you know, see some of these gorgeous places, including some internationally, Costa Rica, and not get disturbed by images of widespread deforestation, or even some early videos I had seen in sort of grade school of the LA smog from decades ago, but of course, you know, still a problem. And I don't know, I just really found that stuff to be concerning. And I always had a propensity, I think, for science, partially because of my mother's exposure or her being a science teacher, an environmental science teacher. It all kind of culminated, like I said, in college. In fact, I first discovered the environmental science degree when I was in seventh grade. And from seventh grade onward, I always knew I wanted to pursue environmental science in college. So it was really exciting to finally go down that track. And then ultimately, like I said, wound up in environmental health, looking more at chemical exposures. And as somebody who studies environmental pollution, you can't be studying that field without this issue of climate change sort of, you know, smacking you head on, because especially air pollution, which ended up being my primary field within environmental health, air pollution is, as you know, the, you know, reason that we've gotten ourselves into this climate change situation. So that became a real passion of mine, mostly actually after graduate school, when I was finally able to part with my, you know, just the science and the dissertation and all that kind of stuff, and finally start engaging in outreach and awareness among the public. So that's at least my story in a nutshell. Happy to elaborate if there's anything you'd like me to kind of expand on.
No, it's always great to understand how people got to where they are and their passion. And for you, it seems like obviously your mother was a very key role in fostering that passion. And I'm sure she must be very proud to see where you're at now and what you've achieved.
Yeah, I think she is. And she's been very supportive along the entire path.
Fantastic. Fantastic. So you've got your new book, which is Beyond Debate, and the first chapter is called Climate Change 101. Could we talk about the sources of greenhouse gases, their provenance, and also so that we can understand how human activities are the main culprit for the rise and the issues?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we think about greenhouse gases, there's a whole host of, for one thing, these specific gases are the gases that are most effective at trapping outgoing radiation from the Earth, and so therefore relevant from a climate perspective. And there's a whole range of different greenhouse gases that are important, both from a human anthropogenic emission standpoint, but also natural sources as well. And those include greenhouse gases such as carbon dioxide and also methane, nitrous oxide, and a few others. But those are your real important ones that we really care most about because they just happen to be emitted in greatest quantity by people. And carbon dioxide is the number one greenhouse gas that we all hear about. It's not necessarily the most potent greenhouse gas, but it is overwhelmingly the greenhouse gas that we emit in greatest quantity. And fossil fuels represent the number one anthropogenic source of greenhouse gas, of carbon dioxide emissions. And, homing in on that a little bit more closely, we're talking about combusting oil, gas, and coal, essentially. And this goes way back, well over a century of those types of emissions. And they've just accumulated in our atmosphere to the point now that we're really seeing what I actually prefer the term climate change acceleration. So we're really seeing an acceleration in this background rate of natural climate variability. And I think that's an important distinction. So we've seen, these greenhouse gases existed in the atmosphere for a long time. They've fluctuated over time, and climate consequently has also fluctuated due to these greenhouse gases and other reasons. And, that variability is expected over time. But the important point is that we're accelerating that background rate of change. We're starting to see temperatures really sharply increase. And a lot of it probably hasn't even come yet. We've got greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide now 50% higher than the pre-industrial levels, and temperature seem to be starting to catch up. But there's a great concern is how far will temperatures creep up as greenhouse gas continues to accumulate at Stark levels.
Absolutely. One of the things I've heard recently is that even if by some miracle we could all stop producing greenhouse gases now, stop the CO2, stop the methane and everything else like that, there would still be a lag in terms of the planet readjusting. And so we could still see, regardless of that, temperatures increasing despite stopping. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. So certain gases are long-lived, and carbon dioxide happens to be one of those. Won't disappear for 100 or 150 years or so once it's emitted into the atmosphere. So we really do need to think long-term about our carbon dioxide emissions. There's other gases like sulfur dioxide, which is a real common air pollutant, mostly from a, acid rain and just sort of respiratory health standpoint, which disappears on the order of a few days or a week. So we can decide, let's stop SO2 emissions tomorrow, and by next week, we could have a cleaner atmosphere. It's not the case with carbon dioxide, and other greenhouse gases have even longer lifetimes in the atmosphere. So absolutely what you said is correct. And it's extremely concerning when we think about climate change, because we don't get the luxury of deciding in a couple decades that we want to sort of grind climate change to a halt, because once you release these, we have to contend with the outcome for quite a long time.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, one of the things here in Australia that worries us is there's a very strong governmental marketing ploy to say, we're going to move to natural gas. That's what they call it. And that this is the cleaner, safer way forward, which basically is methane. Yes, it doesn't stay in the atmosphere as long, but its impact from what we've read and what we've heard is that much greater. Could you sort of describe a little bit more about how this is an issue?
Sure. So methane is the second most important greenhouse gas that we think about when it comes to climate change. And the potency, I mentioned the word potency earlier. So the basically heat trapping ability of different gases varies. And methane happens to be a greenhouse gas that is about 30 times more effective at trapping heat than carbon dioxide. So it's a much more powerful greenhouse gas. And one of the interesting things about methane is once it's released into the atmosphere, it'll basically be much more effective at trapping heat. And once it breaks down, average about 10 years before it oxidizes into a new chemical, that new chemical is CO2. So basically, we have this extremely potent greenhouse gas, and then it just becomes CO2, which is an extremely important greenhouse gas, right? The most important one. So getting back to your question or comment about natural gas being sort of the ideal fuel or, depending on which country. So it's absolutely not the path forward long term. We've heard about it as a potential bridge fuel, but if that bridge is there for, long enough, is it really bridging us anywhere? In 2016 in the United States, methane production, so methane drilling for natural gas, released enough methane into the atmosphere that it accounted for about 40% of the nation's total methane emissions. So there's a lot of sources, agriculture, cows release methane, other ruminants release methane, landfills, certain types of other farming. But just fugitive emissions from the natural gas industry, fossil fuel industry, released 40% of the total quantity in this country. And that suggests that, we have a lot to think about just in terms of leakage from this industry, because it's very practical to think that everything that we're drilling is going to be burned. And when it's burned, it's not being released as methane. It's being released as CO2. But in actuality, there's a lot of evidence that there's quite a bit of leakage. And that's something that should make us even more hesitant to pursue natural gas as a long-term fuel.
How much does the burning fossil fuels account for? Is that a different ratio to what you've already said?
So of total greenhouse gas emissions?
Yes.
So the burning of fossil fuels, I think it's about 2/3 of the greenhouse gas problem. So a hefty fraction. And in the United States, the electricity industry alone is about 25% of total greenhouse gas emissions. There's also fossil fuels, however, largely in the transportation sector, which are another 30%. And that's not even considering the methane emissions.
Yeah. So where does the remaining emission come from? So we talked about burning fossil fuels and methane. What else do we have?
So just speaking broadly about greenhouse gases, taking carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide, the main sources of these gases, number one, fossil fuels overwhelmingly emitting, the highest fraction. But then we also have agricultural practices that are releasing methane, as I mentioned, and cattle ranching, the types of animals that are ruminants like cattle, including lamb, are going to be emitting methane. And then you also have landfills. So when we send all of our waste to the dump, the biodegradation processes, as things break down, essentially turn into carbon dioxide and methane. So that represents a pretty good fraction as well. But we also have rice paddies. So agriculture related to rice, rice is grown in a sort of swampy type of environment. That's also a big fraction of methane emissions. Nitrous oxide, another important greenhouse gas, comes from agriculture as well. So tend to be fertilizer related, slowly outgassing from agricultural fields. So those are your real big greenhouse gas sources. There's other sources such as ozone type and CFC related greenhouse gases coming from certain industrial processes and things like that. But overwhelmingly, the ones that that are kind of explaining most of what's happened so far and is going to happen, CO2, methane, nitrous oxide are your primary ones. And those are the key sources to think about. And those are anthropogenic sources. So I'm sticking to the human sources in this discussion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We obviously generally know why climate change is happening, but we don't know how exactly. And in your book, you mention about record-breaking temperatures for the last 20 years in the about the tipping point. How does that affect us and how is it manifested?
So the tipping point is a very important issue to understand. And basically, one of the best examples of a so-called tipping point phenomenon would be the melting of the tundra. So or the thawing, I should say, of the tundra. So frozen soils around the Arctic and sort of Arctic Circle region. There's a lot of organic material that's been locked up in those soils. And as we heat them up, they are going to start those biodegradation processes and then release methane and CO2. So just a matter of a degree, you know, is what it takes to go from freezing to frozen ice to water, right? And we're starting to see some of those soils thaw. And when that happens, we've got a new source of greenhouse gas emissions that's totally separate from any anthropogenic sources. So that really is one of the most, I think, stark examples of a true tipping point where we could actually see a small change in temperature in a certain region of the globe trigger a huge release of greenhouse gases over a decade or a few decades, and therefore sort of snowball this climate change scenario to a point where humans may not have the capacity to suddenly grind, you know, temperature increases to a halt, because it's no longer an anthropogenic problem. It's really then turns into a natural problem that's going to be difficult to arrest. There's other examples of tipping points, including, or I should say, positive feedbacks, which is what we're talking about, that play into this tipping point phenomenon, such as the melting of ice, which typically ice is reflecting sunlight. And as we thaw and melt these surfaces, they turn from bright surfaces to dark water and land underlying surfaces, absorbing a lot of heat as opposed to reflecting that heat. And as we continue to sort of turn up the temperature dial of the earth, so to speak, those melting surfaces are enough to perpetuate warming or amplify warming. So it's sort of another example of, if these ice surfaces continue to melt, they perpetuate further melting, forgetting about what the original cause of the warming was. And those self-perpetuated processes are really dangerous processes that we should really try to leave alone and not kick into gear. Even climate models that project future warming, most don't take into account these peripheral positive feedback effects, which have the real capacity to amplify warming to a significant extent. So that is the sort of tipping point. The manifestation is very different depending on where you are. And it really gets at the difference between the phrase global warming and climate change. So global warming accurately is relating or reflecting the average increase in global average temperatures, whereas climate change is really getting at the expression of that global average temperature increase, which is not necessarily just a warmer climate, but a changing climate. Yeah. And the change is going to be very different depending on where you are. So we've seen in Alaska temperature warming records that basically in the heart of winter, we're seeing very warm temperatures. And then in Texas, as you saw recently, and you know, it's difficult to call any one event a climate event, but this, I think, at least serves as the example. Places like Texas or in the South may see extremely frigid temperatures. I was living in Boston, and it was the coldest temperatures we would see would be typically February, January, and the Fahrenheit, at least, temperature was about 0 degrees, 5 degrees or so. Mm-hmm. And in the year after I left, of course, as luck would have it, that warmer temperatures came when I had left the area. They were wearing short sleeves and shorts on a couple of days in February, which is just completely unheard of. Now, what is, you know, the underlying reason for this? So there's a polar vortex that circles the northern hemisphere up around the Arctic. And one of the expected outcomes as we increase the global average temperature is to start to see the destabilization of this basically polar vortex wind pattern that circulates the northern hemisphere. And as that destabilizes, you see basically temperatures that are very cold start to, if you can kind of imagine a circular ring of wind around the north, if it starts to destabilize, you start to get sort of more of a meandering pattern. And what that can do is drop some of those Arctic temperatures to more southern regions. And it can also allow warmer air to penetrate further into the north. So that is one of the reasons that we can see extreme record-breaking temperatures of sort of opposite, you know, direction.
Yeah.
And warm temperatures in Boston and cold temperatures in Alaska or Texas.
Yeah.
So that's just kind of the temperature endpoint of things. But there's a whole bunch of indirect things we can think about too, such as infectious disease and precipitation patterns. Where I live, a lot of precipitation has been falling in sort of record quantity. And that's also consistent with a warmer atmosphere. So just the physics of warm air is that it can hold more water. And you think of the atmosphere as a sponge. The warmer it is, the more water it can retain. And come time for a precipitation event, the capacity to be a record-breaking precipitation event is a lot higher as we warm up the atmosphere. And we're starting to see that across the Midwest. I interviewed farmers during our tour, one of which explained that they had seen 17 inches of rain fall in just a 24-hour period. And that's nothing they had ever seen before. And it, of course, is going to wash out your fields, lead to extreme soil erosion and so on and so forth. This is just another example, but, I don't want to go on too endlessly, but hurricanes would be another one. So as we warm up the surface temperatures of the oceans, the likelihood of a hurricane going from a category 2 or 3 to a category 4 or 5 is much greater. So, hurricanes feed off of that surface temperature, and the warmer it is, the easier it is to transition into a more powerful storm.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We touched on it, or you touched on it earlier, and I couldn't pick up exactly the phrase, but it was trying to understand the difference between, I guess, the natural climate change process and the man-made one. And I think you called it almost like a speeding up of the temperature change. Could you describe that a little further for us?
Sure. So, when we look at climate change going back, hundreds of thousands of years, we see natural variability in climate, in temperature, and even in greenhouse gas concentrations. So, there is a cyclical nature to the climate. And when you look at that data, we actually see these cycles tend to come in about 100,000 year increments. That's at least going back for the last 800,000 or so years. So about every 100,000 years or so, we see a new carbon dioxide temperature maximum. And, what this evidence and this data tells us is that, yes, climate change existed far before we were driving cars or powering industry or far before we were ever a civilized population. And what it also tells us is that we have to keep in mind when we talk about climate change that the climate has always changed. And I think that, people who are skeptical of climate change, at least the way it's talked about or that phrase in general, have a point when they say, well, the climate's always changed, so why are you concerned about this thing called climate change? And in fact, everything changes. You buy a new house, in 10 years, it's an old house, right? So everything's changing all the time. And that's why I sort of raised the phrase or mentioned the phrase climate change acceleration, because it really, I think, gets at the heart of the fact that we'll always see climate change. We always have, we always will. But there is an acceleration of that rate of change, which is due to anthropogenic activity. So the injection of all these greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. The natural change that we've had over the millions of years that we've got climate-related data is explained by a variety of different factors, including the orientation of the Earth to the sun, so-called Milankovitch cycles, which relate to the Earth's degree of wobble, the shape of the orbit around the Earth. And these things actually explain quite well the 100,000-year cycles that we've seen, at least over the last million years or so. And currently, when we look at, by the way, those cycles operate on tens of thousands of year timescales. Yeah. They're very slow, gradual processes. But currently, we're seeing temperatures shoot up decade after decade. And these are not explainable by these natural climate drivers. They simply are not. These cycles are essentially static over just a couple decades or so. So when we look at the different climate drivers that do exist, including these Milankovitch cycles or solar cycles, which actually operate on just every 10 years, which is very short, or greenhouse gas emissions is another important climate driver. It's the greenhouse gas emissions that, you know, line up very in sync with the temperature increases that we've been seeing. Having said that, that's by no means the sole evidence on which climate change, is sort of hinged. There's just so many different ways to look at climate change that show that we have a clear problem on our hands and that it's linked to greenhouse gas emissions.
Absolutely. So understanding then the cyclical change, by how much has the temperature changed, say, in the last two decades? I mean, we've heard in many places that they're already over or possibly even well over the 1.5 degrees. Sorry, this is in centigrade for us, 1.5 degrees centigrade increase.
Yeah, sure. So over the last couple of decades, the change in global average temperature is on the order of a fraction of a degree centigrade. And I don't have the exact fraction in my head, but it's very minor. And actually that kind of gets at the notion that really the average temperature change is not a very alarming number, right? We're talking about a digit, actually a 1 degree temperature change, or maybe a 2 or a 3 in some of the worst scenarios and potentially 50 years or so. But where you are, it may have changed much more dramatically. So in the North Pole, we're seeing temperature changes that are on the order of double digit changes on average. Wow. So 10, 11 or more degrees Fahrenheit. So the difference can be very dramatic depending on where you are. And we're seeing that no more clearly than in the Arctic, which is kind of what we'd expect, is those extremely cold areas are going to be hit hardest. Again, that's just the sort of temperature side of things. And then we have all the different climate related weather phenomena that have the potential to be quite dire.
Absolutely. And I guess it goes back to what you said earlier about, you know, if we're seeing vast temperature changes in our poles, then the tundra melt and everything else like that, it will then speed up the process, and it snowballs into a bigger, for want of a better word, snowballs into a bigger problem that we then can't manage.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And I think that, you know, it's always difficult, as I mentioned, to attribute any single meteorological incident as a climate disaster or what have you. But if, you know, what we've been seeing in recent years, just taking hurricanes as an example, back to back Category 5 hurricanes and 4 hurricanes have sort of ripped up the southern, you know, seaboard and the eastern seaboard in recent years in the United States. Whether or not those are attributable to climate change, those are the kinds of storms that we are fearful of when it comes to climate change. And by fearful, I don't mean just fearful. I mean, evidence-based concern. This, I think, should be a real sort of, wake-up call. If we are not desiring those kinds of storms moving forward, then we really ought to take greenhouse gas emissions and climate change very seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can't remember the figures, but one of the conversations we had a while ago was that the do-nothing scenario and the damage from the continued and increased intensity of these storms far outweighs the number that it would take to start putting more funds into greener energy and so forth. And yet it's still frustratingly not happening as much as we would like.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. It's the something that I think is really important to talk about when I give climate change presentations, that is the cost of inaction. You know, we have there's a lot that's been said about the cost of climate change and people sort of, billions and billions of dollars or trillions of dollars. I think politicians, in fact, invoke the cost of climate change as a real popular tool to scare people away from wanting to support any kind of climate action. But what's less talked about and what needs to be talked about more is the cost of inaction. And those figures can stack up very quickly, whether it's lost labor hours due to high, heat waves, or whether it's hurricane related disaster damage, or what have you. So yeah, you make a good point, and it's incredibly important to sort of juxtapose those two, which I think supports the notion for climate action 100%.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So we were watching a documentary a little while ago about the Great Green Wall Project in Africa. And an important part of this was the migration of people to European countries due to climate change locally to them. Climate migration is already happening, and we're seeing it more and more prevalent at the moment. How would you see this affecting us, and how are the migrants and their lives directly affected by these, I guess, localized climate changes?
Yeah, it's a good question. There's no doubt that climate refugees are a thing now, and we're starting to see refugees mostly moving within nations, but there are events and incidences that show refugees moving across international borders as well. And in fact, even in the United States, we see in the wake of disasters, a lot of migration between states. So the underdeveloped countries are at a disproportionate disadvantage with respect to climate change adaptation and just dealing with climate impacts for a variety of reasons. They tend to be mostly their economy tends to be predominantly involved in agriculture and farming, and those sectors, that sector specifically, is one that's going to be hit hard with climate change because it's of course so weather dependent. We have droughts and heavy precipitation events, both of which can dramatically impact an agricultural, production in different ways. And now that's just the economy side of things. There's also a lot of subsistence people in underdeveloped countries who are simply farming for their own selves and their families. And Africa, lots of countries in Africa that fit that mold. And we can't understate the devastation that shifting climate patterns is having and can continue to have on these civilizations that are simply already struggling to put food on the tables and whose economies are already, not necessarily comparable anywhere to some of the more developed countries. So this kind of makes climate change a big environmental justice crisis, as well as just a general global crisis. These nations and these people, whether it's more people of color in the United States, or whether it's people internationally who are more disadvantaged and also are basically marginalized in other ways, it's a huge environmental crisis that I think maybe isn't talked about enough, but it's an extremely important point.
Absolutely. The climate change injustice is going to be a key point for many people's lives as well. But also in terms of the global economy, it's going to affect that as well. And it's one of these things that seems to be pushed under the carpet a little bit, and people aren't willing to open up to it as much as we would like. Along with that, I'd like to sort of touch on where, I guess, the future of our food and water sources will be as climate changes.
It's a good question, and I wish I had the answer for that. I think that we're going to probably start seeing, here in California, there's been some investment in using water from the ocean. It's an extremely expensive process, these desalination plants. Yeah. We may see more of those popping up. water security is definitely something that is important to consider. And I don't know exactly how the future is going to play out with respect to agriculture, but there's definitely, I would suspect there's going to be quite a bit of change. And we're starting to see in the United States, for instance, the Corn Belt, the so-called Corn Belt, start to slowly migrate north, where we're now mm-hmm. seeing Canadian farmers start to grow more corn and U.S. farmers actually shifting to other crops that are actually more mm-hmm. adept at dealing with the warmer temperatures we're seeing. So mm-hmm. I think we'll start to see some more shifts like that, where people are having to abandon certain crops for other crops. In fact, I interviewed a farmer who also attested to the same adaptation process. He used to grow vegetables, potatoes, corn, that kind of thing, and basically gave up on all of those in the last 10-15 years, because it's just not, the springs are changing, the temperature and precipitation timing is changing. So now he's growing blueberries and mostly perennial berries and a lot of native seeds for pollinators and things like that. So, that's just a couple of examples in the United States, but we'll most likely, there's most likely a lot of that already playing out around the world in different sort of shapes and forms. And how that's going to impact the global sort of maybe food prices, one would suspect that food prices are going to go up over time as we see sort of agricultural disruption take place. But an X factor there is, of course, subsidies, right? So farm subsidies are already tremendous in the United States. So, how that changes over time is going to dramatically determine how price changes occur within the country. Yeah. So
we've already seen in Australia food prices increase because of some of the natural events happening here. So that's definitely something to come. How do you see, talking about food and agriculture, how do you see the effects of intensive animal agriculture on the planet, and what can we do about it?
I see the effects as being devastating for the planet and consequently devastating for humanity. I think that one of the most important ways that we can contribute to basically a climate solution is to think about animal agriculture and not only in sort of the top-down approach, but also from the bottom-up approach. So I think that individuals who want to do something to reduce their carbon footprint need to start thinking about their personal diet. And, it doesn't necessarily mean you have to become a vegetarian or a vegan, and certainly not overnight, but just simply reducing the consumption that we all engage in of animal products. Beef tends to be the most highly carbon polluting animal product out there, especially when you take into account the extent to which it's consumed. But milk and cheese and all these animal products are problematic from an environmental standpoint. And it turns out it's not just greenhouse gases. It's also water consumption. It's also agricultural pollution to rivers, lakes, and streams, pesticide use, all that stuff really is just much more dramatic when we talk about animal agriculture. And that's essentially because animal agriculture houses within it plant agriculture. So it's basically a double whammy, whereas plant agriculture, of course, is just plant agriculture. So it's essential, I think, to take steps towards the reduction of consumption of those products. And that's not necessarily going to go away if we just try to do away with the concentrated animal feeding operations, the CAFOs, and bring about, better standards for animals and things like that. We still can't really get around the supply demand problem as it relates to the available space for producing these animals in the world. And nowhere probably is this more of an issue right now than in the Amazon, where we're seeing, widespread deforestation and burning of the Amazon, which yeah. incidentally is an issue of animal, demand, right? Because most of the burning taking place is human burning, and it's in order to clear space to have cattle, right? So we can consume yeah. burgers. So yeah, it's a great point you've raised and needs to be a part of any conversation that we have regarding climate change solutions, climate change mitigation.
I think it's worth mentioning as well that with the deforestation, we're actually losing biodiversity. Everyone, I think, is seeing the effects of extinction in animal extinct, but not many people make the connection between the loss of habitat and the fact that we are actually eating too much meat to actually contain within our planet. And the more forests we cut, the more animals we'll lose. I hope people make that connection between deforestation and the meat consume, I think.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. And incidentally, you find even animal sort of documentaries, I shouldn't say animal documentaries, but environmental documentaries, I've seen many which leave out that piece. And that, in fact, animal agriculture is the number one reason for deforestation globally. I mean, that it's not, you know, cutting wood trees down to build houses or you know, something like that. So yeah, it's so important and not nearly talked about enough.
Yeah. I think it's still almost a politically painful subject for a lot of people that they don't want to mention it and they don't want the backlash of saying, oh, I'm vegan or I'm vegetarian or I want to reduce meat or things. And they don't want the backlash. There's still stigma, ridiculously, about it as well. And I mean, I've had it even in workplaces where people, you know, suggest that by having a meat-free or a vegan diet as we have, that for some reason that therefore makes me inferior, weaker, and everything else like that. It's ridiculous that that is still the case, but I am slowly seeing change.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think it's 100% the case. And it's not even just the social settings, but there's heavy pressure from the meat industry. In fact, I was part of a sort of roundtable to help a rather prestigious university think about ways to reduce food waste. I'm sorry, to reduce the carbon footprint of the university. And I was sort of shocked to hear the facilitator of that roundtable, who was a faculty member, say, when somebody raised the idea of having a well-advertised Meatless Monday campaign across the university, I was surprised to hear the facilitator say, oh no, we don't want to deal with the meat industry. And that's the reality. And that was a very well endowed institution. So to hear that be spoken was, I think, reflective of what's probably happening all across the world.
Yeah. It is. We know of a documentary that aired at BBC back in the UK about meat and reducing meat consumption. And that was generated a scandal, really, with the meat industry there. And I think the meat industry went hard on BBC to remove the documentary. And that documentary is removed now just because of that, just because of the meat industry influences in every economy. It's a hard one to pass easily.
Yeah, wow, that's sad to hear. I think there was a famous situation on the Oprah Winfrey show where she got a lot of flack and lawsuits from the meat industry for having said that we should not eat meat, or had interviewed somebody on her show about that. So yeah, it can't be overstated, I think, the intimidation and the legal problems one might face in certain positions to have that stance.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So can you tell us more about the On the Road for Climate Action project?
Sure. Yeah. So this was a project that I launched in 2018 with my then girlfriend, now fiance, Athena, who basically, or I should say, which was essentially an expression of wanting to do more on the climate outreach front. So, you know, I do a fair amount of research and science and sort of sitting at my computer and taking care of the technicals and things like that. But I feel like was starting to feel so significantly at that time that, you know, there's a lot of great scientists out there doing great work. There's already a lot of very well-published, important scientific literature and different studies out there that speak to this issue of climate change. But in engaging in sort of your everyday social circle, I was seeing that there's a huge gap between what's talked about and discussed in the scientific community and what's actually being received and talked about in the just general everyday public community. Yeah. So I thought, geez, there's got to be more communication of that science to the public. So this idea of kind of going on the road for climate action to communicate those scientific messages to the public sort of came to me as a light bulb when I was at a climate conference in DC. And Athena was all about the idea. She's an adventurer at heart, and she basically signed right on. So she was finishing up her graduate degree program, and I had a contract to finish with the university. And we said, all right, after that, let's put our lives on hold and just go on the road for climate action, and let's do this. We didn't have any funding, but we were going to be dedicating ourselves to doing what we had to do. To whether, you know, it was coming out of our own pockets or not, we were going to go on the road. And we sort of committed 100%, made a promo video, started advertising on social media, giving talks locally. And come August 2018, we were giving our first talk in Las Vegas. And we just took it from there across 36 different states over about 3 months, and came back, organized phase two of that, and headed out to about 16 different cities over another 6 weeks in 2019. So it was a pretty large undertaking, and it really was starting out, you know, the idea was, again, to go out there and shed awareness and inspire communities. But we also wanted to bring the stories, the everyday stories of climate change that people are experiencing around the country, bring those to the public. So we basically started, we decided to do a lot of interviews along the way. We actually took a survey, 24 question survey on the road with us. We've published the results from that survey in, I think it was back in November, 2020. And the project has really just kind of become many different shapes and forms and pieces. And our website, my website, shahirmonstery.com, features a lot of the videos from that trip. It's been a real pleasure to take part in such a project. And, you know, we've kind of been on the road this year virtually. So doing podcasts like yours and giving talks to different groups around the country has always been a pleasure, and still taking place now. So that's kind of in a nutshell, the road for climate action.
How was that received? Obviously, the state's big on oil and animal agriculture. So how is that received? Are people willing to change, to move on, to help our climate action? Or are they worried about their future? What did you feel from your trip?
So it's a good question. And I have to say that, you know, when you go on the road for climate action, what you tend to find, which I found, is that your presentations are predominantly attended by people who already take interest in the issue and care. So we did see sort of an attendance bias in that regard. But one of the interesting things we learned from our surveys, so to answer your question, we weren't getting heckled off stage or booed or anything like that, which, you know, I will say in certain areas, we were prepared for that to potentially happen. And in certain areas we were, I think, we did have some of those people in the audience because the organizers really tried to get them to show up, but they were polite. Even the people who disagree with you, they pose good questions, challenge you a little bit. But overall, we were received politely by everyone everywhere we went. But getting back to what I was saying, so there's a real, I think, attendance bias that you're going to naturally see when you give these talks. But from the surveys, we learned that actually a little more than 50% of the, maybe let's call them green people or climate concerned individuals, actually checked on the survey that they had never contacted a congressperson on the issue of climate change. So what we saw was, yes, a lot of people who already cared about the issue, but an enormous fraction of these people who actually hadn't really taken political action on the issue. And this is a real important point, because that's what we really need to do moving forward, is elect people to Congress and to the presidency and at the state level, people who, for one, accept the science of climate change, but also have a plan to publicly support climate action and actually take action. So there was a real, I think, underscoring of the need to sort of drive that message home that, you know, hey, people, you guys care about climate change. All right, let's mobilize, let's start voting and that kind of thing. So it was a real, I think, important learning experience. And it really shows that we've got a lot of work still to do within even the people who care about climate change.
Yeah.
So are you planning to take this internationally and move to other countries?
You know, I would love to. I've thought about that, and it's hard for me to, you know, from a carbon footprint standpoint, it's hard for me to justify going internationally before I have finished the national project. So you kind of mentioned this in a timely period, because I'm actually in the middle of thinking about a potential third national project that will take us across the remaining states that we haven't covered, which actually include much of the farm belt. So much of the agricultural area that we didn't go to across the middle of the United States. So we tended to hug a lot of the coastline and go through potentially some of your more, I guess, progressive states as a whole. So we want to tackle the farm belt, go through the middle, and 100%, I'd like to take the project internationally. Funding is a major obstacle for any type of this kind of project. So it's not cheap to for one thing, stop working and for another to then go on the road. So I'm all open to funding sources. You just point them my way and we'll chit chat. We did a little bit of climate surveying when we were in Peru in 2019. And that was pretty neat, having a lot of conversations with people. I did a couple of video interviews out there, but we'd certainly like to expand this to other nations as well.
So we obviously have seen many news bits from the States and with regards to the climate change and its effects on certain areas. What did you see in your trip?
So, wow, a lot of stories that we encountered. One that just jumps out at me is a lady who gave me a tour of her house, and she basically was explaining that. And this is an issue that has to do with precipitation and also land use change, conversion of forest land to grass and lawns and things like that, paving. But basically the river where she lives near is about it's like a 4 foot wide creek. And over the decades that she's lived there her whole life, as I recall, in the last couple decades, mostly the last, I think it was 10 years or so, this river has continued to expand. And now during the biggest storms, this river, which used to sit maybe 75 feet away, again, a little creek, during the peak season, she has to open her, this is hard to believe, she has to open the sliding doors of her house in preparation for this river to wash through her living room so that it doesn't break the sliding glass doors.
Wow.
So she sees dramatic flooding inside of her home now. And again, she was not right on the creek. She's a good 75 feet or so away, maybe 12 feet above the creek bottom. So that was just one example. In that area, we had actually seen quite a bit of erosion due to heavy precipitation that has been getting worse, wiping out homes and businesses. And we were visiting Florida. A big issue that's going on in Florida that taps into the sort of environmental justice sphere is the sea level rise, which is basically displacing people from the coastline, but importantly, making land developers get very interested about in some of the higher elevation areas in Southern Florida. And there aren't too many of them. One of them happens to be Little Haiti, where people who are low income minority groups. And we're starting to see companies buy up that property. The rate of rent is just skyrocketing. People are having to move out who've lived there their whole lives. So that's real sad. We interviewed a woman there who's part of the community in Miami-Dade County that is seeing this happen. And she talked about it with us. And people are having to leave and go elsewhere, but their jobs are still in that area. So now their commute is going from maybe like 15 minutes to an hour. It's just another example of, like I said, environmental justice playing into the climate problem. The stories really are numerous and range from people whose cars were washed away in hurricanes and they couldn't get any kind of coverage. They apparently, in order to get covered insurance coverage for your car to to be washed away, you have to recover the car. So they didn't actually have the damaged flooded car to prove that their car was washed away and damaged, and therefore they got no flood insurance or back from that. So that was just kind of ridiculous and sad to hear. So, again, just kind of one of many such examples. I'm incidentally writing up many of these stories right now into what I hope to be my second book to be published in, you know, the foreseeable future. So I would really like to share a lot of these stories with the public. And that's the project I'm working on at the moment to sort of to express yeah. those stories.
I think that would be fantastic. I think it's hearing those personal stories is a lot more relatable to people to actually therefore understand the effects of what's happening.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that there's been a lot of parts per million and percent this and percent that yeah. and projections. And I think what really moves people to action is stories, you know, and that's yeah. probably why the entertainment industry is so large, and maybe the True. Climate movement has to take a chip from that playbook.
Absolutely. So often people assume that climate change is about weather, and we've touched on it slightly, but there's also a huge, we've touched on the animal effect slightly. And what I kind of wanted to understand is what are the further effects of climate change and animal, you know, for example, migration patterns, both aquatic and airborne and all those kind of things.
Yeah. So the whole species and animal implications of climate change are very important because, you know, that's of course going to relate, you know, we care about animals and species, but even if you're just human centric, this is going to relate directly back to human success as a species and survival. And, what you're seeing is poleward migrations in many cases where animals are sort of trickling closer and closer to the poles, getting away from the areas that are warmest. Mm-hmm. And this is feasible for some species, but for many species, it's not. And some examples that I point out in my book are the areas, for instance, in the cloud forests of Costa Rica, where you've got, and this is the case for mountains in general, basically a species that is subjected to warmer weather, let's say in the middle of the mountain, they're going to kind of follow the cooler average that they are adapted to. And that, in the case of a mountain range, oftentimes means moving up vertically. So they're going to occupy higher and higher altitudes. And when you get to the summit of a mountain, there's just nowhere to go. So yeah. as these sort of summit areas start to peak into warmer temperatures, unfortunately, it's going to mean the loss of certain precious species. We saw some of this in Utah, where we were interviewing a park ranger, and there's an animal. It's a kind of like a little fluffy, cute little rodent animal that occupies high elevation mountains in that area. And they're one of the species that they're actually starting to see as sort of like a first climate potential species to be lost of climate change as it's moving higher and higher altitudes and actually vacating places at 12,000 feet where it used to live. Well, these mountains are only 14,000 feet or so. So it's, you know, not clear as to when we might lose these species, at least in that area, but there's certainly evidence of that happening in that particular area. And we're seeing, of course, evidence elsewhere globally, as I mentioned, Costa Rica being one example. And this also brings up another important point, which is when we think about animal migration, there's not always places to migrate. So when we think about the way that humans have sort of chopped up the globe, whether it be roadways or cities, industrial areas, there's not always a place to migrate. If you're just a terrestrial species that migrates by foot, okay, sure, if you're a bird, you can fly. But if you're just a terrestrial species and you come up against a major city or, you know, series of roads, it's not going to be that easy necessarily to migrate. And that's just an important point as well. It's foreseeable and theoretically possible, you know, to have species migrate to the poles, but in practice, it doesn't always happen. And when we think about animal sanctuaries, therein lies another important point. We have staked out certain areas in certain parts of the world that are animal sanctuaries that we're happy we're protecting certain species. Well, what happens as the temperature isotherms move outward beyond the actual sanctuary? Well, these species are no longer going to be inhabiting that area that was once protected. So we get into real issues there as well. So it's just further evidence that we don't want to see this climate change issue progress, and we really need to do everything we can to help arrest continued warming, because there's just a cascade of problems, both environmental and societal, that can very, you know, foreseeably take place and are already starting to take place.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about your book, and we've touched on it in places as well. So your book, Beyond Debate, Answers to 50 Misconceptions on Climate Change. So what would you say are the most common misconceptions that you hear and therefore into your book?
So I think the most common misconception that I hear is one that is only partially a misconception, in fact, and we kind of talked about it earlier, which is this notion that climate change is natural. That's mm-hmm. oftentimes one of the sort of first things you hear when somebody's skeptical about climate change. Well, climate change is natural. And again, I think that so the misconception piece of that is that, you know, that statement kind of is implying that what's happening today is just natural. So it's a misconception because of the evidence that suggests to the contrary. But the part that's not really misplaced is the fact that, yeah, climate change does have a natural component. So I would say that's the number one misconception that I hear is basically just kind of suggesting that what we're seeing now is just natural variability. And, yeah. And hopefully that chapter that I kind of talk about that in the book underscores what I view to be a real opportunity to form a bridge with a skeptical person. Mm-hmm. That is, you have a chance in that sort of interaction to actually say, hey, you're right, you know, and that often brings people's walls down, makes it more amenable to conversation. So I hope that that's of value, kind of thinking about it from that way. Other misconceptions Absolutely. That are prevalent, I think that it kind of depends on which audience you're talking to. In the political sort of sphere, I remember hearing, you know, well, carbon dioxide is not actually an air pollutant. Actually, this kind of, well, for one thing, in some cases, depending on how you're viewing it, yeah, strictly speaking, for a long time under U.S. law, it was not an air pollutant. It was, you know, when we think about our conventional air pollutants like, you know, carbon monoxide and particulate matter and ozone and whatnot. But now that's changed over time. But that's kind of a misplaced point, right? And there's a whole host mm-hmm. of different pollutants that are emitted from the same sources that emit CO2. So, you know, all kinds of heavy metals, particulate matter, things that are bad for us to breathe are emitted right in concert with these CO2 and other gases. So I think that a common one is that CO2 is going to be good for agriculture. Because of, you know, a lot of the misconceptions come from a little bit of truth. And that's what kind of makes them so widespread, is that there is some element of, oh, yeah, that makes sense. And then people sort of cling on to it. And that's the importance of sort of dedicating a book to debunking these, is because they do dabble in some truth. And we need to kind of dive in to reconcile, you know, well, where did they go wrong? Yeah. And the idea that CO2 is good for agriculture sort of stems from the, you know, elementary notion and understanding that humans breathe in oxygen and plants breathe in CO2. So more CO2 is going to be good for the entities that breathe CO2, such as plants. Now it's true with more CO2, we do see some increased productivity of plants, but it's at a very minor increase in CO2. And then you sort of top out and plants don't do any better. And the obvious reason behind that is that there's a whole host of different things required for a plant to survive. You know, we can't just give humans more water and food and expect them to be 8 feet tall and, you know, giants. So the other limiting nutrients for plants or limiting factors include nitrogen, which, you know, is very important when we think of fertilization. A lot, you know, fertilizers, one of the most important things they do is they impart nitrogen to the soil. So soils that don't have this limiting nutrient, which is prevalent, you know, globally, it's a limiting nutrient, are going to basically limit a plant's growth. So CO2, okay, you increase it a little bit. Let's put aside, by the way, all the climate impacts that come from increased CO2. So we're forgetting about that for just the moment. And you still run into the issue of nitrogen deficiency in the soil. And so the second tier, then, once we've kind of reconciled that the nutrient issue is the fact that, okay, well, when we increase CO2, we also bring about climate destabilization and heat waves and dramatic precipitation events. And none of this is good for agriculture. Mm-hmm. So it's an important misconception to take note of. Now, there are, of course, going to be instances where agriculture improves in certain areas, just getting at the fact that climate is changing, and that's going to maybe benefit some areas and cause real harm to others. But as a net sort of effect, we are not going to see, and neither are we projecting to see agriculture to kind of just boom because of CO2 increases. We've actually increased CO2 plenty over the last few decades, and that has not given way to some birth of agriculture. There's other reasons why agriculture has grown, but it's not the reason.
Yeah. So there's an important part in your book called Solutions. If you are to pick four or five solutions that we must all take on now, what would you consider imperative?
So I think that we have to, it's imperative that we get out and vote and use our abilities to vote, because, you know, we've been talking about carbon footprint for, you know, decades, and there's just been very little done on the front of climate change. We're seeing climate, you know, greenhouse gases higher, emissions higher than at any time before. And it's just not going to be solved by some philanthropic people or eco-minded people reducing, you know, their carbon footprint a little bit, or using reusable bags or reusable water bottles. It's really time for top-down changes. We need economic incentives to basically reduce our carbon footprint. And this means putting a price on carbon dioxide emissions or just greenhouse gas emissions. Sometimes you hear this referred to as a carbon tax. Sometimes you hear it as a carbon fee and dividend. And getting this passed is very necessary, but also sensible. We've done this with other pollutants. You know, it's not legal to dispose of hazardous waste just openly into the rivers and lakes and streams. You can't drop hazardous waste off at the neighboring soccer field and drive away. This is going to cost you money. For one thing, you get a ticket or a fine. And for another, you actually have to pay to go dispose it. And that has not been the case for greenhouse gases. We've been treating the atmosphere like an open waste dump for, you know, as long as we've been around here to pollute it. So it's time for that to change. And some states have imparted some such changes, but we need to see that at the federal level in the United States and also at the federal levels in other nations. So getting that done is not something that an individual can do by simply making behavioral changes. We need to make those behavioral changes also when it comes to civic duty and getting out and voting. So I put that at the top of the sort of what I have been calling my three pillars to climate action. And the second pillar that I think of is basically outreach and education. So there's a lot of people who accept climate change and are concerned about climate change. And I think it's really time to start having these conversations, even as awkward as they might be at the dinner table or what have you. Yep. Talking to your community. I think about the one project I did where we went on the road, spoke to, you know, 60 or so different communities over a few months. And, you know, if we had even a fraction of that taking place, I think at the local level, and by the way, there's a lot that could be done without getting in your car and driving very far. Mm-hmm. I think that's one sort of way to start really getting the conversation going and to, start getting people's mind thinking about climate change, not only just as an abstract situation, but something that they can actually affect at the local level through either voting or behavioral change. And also using social media to do some climate outreach, even sharing the articles. There's some organizations that are really big on writing for the papers and trying to get publications out there. But not everybody's got the particular passion to write and the particular skill set to maybe tap into some newspaper that's going to, it's actually challenging to get anything published in the papers, you know? So for for a lot of people, I think we really should just be talking about sharing articles that are already existing, that are out there to share them. The headline of the Arctic melting in the dead of winter, that kind of thing needs to be popping up in people's news feeds. And we have a real opportunity to do that, that we haven't had in prior generations just because of social media, and we all have followers and platforms. So I can't underestimate the importance of that. Part of the reason why these are my top two sort of in order, civic duty and outreach, is they really are so easy to do. You know, it's not hard to go to a voting booth. It's not hard to post something on social media. So it's very easy to have them at the top of your to-do list when it comes to climate change. They also are extremely effective and important. But when we get to the third tier, which I see as carbon footprint, so a lot of the things we talked about, whether it's diet or, you know, using less energy, buying a fuel efficient car, or taking more public transportation, these are actual substantial lifestyle changes that don't, you know, they actually have the potential to discourage people, and maybe they never even got to anything else because they saw that these are the number one things they should do, and they thought, oh geez, if I can't even do these, then why bother with anything? Well, I think we should reverse it. Go vote. Go share some stuff on social media. And now let's talk about some of the hard behavioral changes, which I still think are really important. And that includes, again, following the guidelines that your medical doctor would tell you if you ask them, how can I eat healthier? Eat more fruits and vegetables, more nuts, lower on the food chain. Well, that's the same thing that climate scientists or scientists in general would tell you about trying to improve your carbon footprint. So, you know, whether it's those carbon, those behavioral changes from a diet standpoint, or like I said, transportation, these are all still important to consider. But that is sort of the hierarchy that I've come up with.
Absolutely. So on your first pillar, going back to that slightly, do you see any loosening of the fossil fuels lobby's grip on key politicians, perhaps especially now that the climate action is becoming more prevalent?
Yeah, I think that we're definitely starting to see, I can't necessarily pinpoint specific politicians per se that I have in mind, but I think we're starting to see through hard work of organizations and in general, climate change sentiment changing, politicians from the Republican Party starting to acknowledge climate change as a serious issue. The Citizens Climate Lobby has been really active politically. They've been around for about a dozen years or so, and they have one thing in mind: try to get a carbon fee and dividend passed through Congress. And now we actually are seeing that come onto the table in the United States. There's several different similar carbon proposals on the floor of Congress. And I think that, so for the House Climate Solutions Caucus, which is sort of founded by the Citizens Climate Lobby, in order to join this caucus in the House, the U.S. House of Representatives, you have to basically join in pairs. So it's one Republican and one Democrat. Yeah. So you join in pairs. And we saw that actually grow quite considerably to, I think it was like 85 Congress people at one point before the midterm elections. And now we have to start over. but I think that shows a sort of turning tide. Now, with respect to the fossil fuel industry, there's tremendous hurdles that remain to be overcome in order to, you know, part with fossil fuels. But we, I think, are starting to, even the fossil fuel industry is realizing that they're going to have to concede certain things moving forward. And they're probably going to have to see some subsidies disappear. They're going to have to contend with a growing green economy, a growing electricity utility sector that is not fossil fuel based. And that's just how the economy is going. We're seeing coal be slowly phased out, not because we're banning coal plants, but because market forces are at work. And yeah, coal is no longer the cheapest form of energy. Now, it just so happens that another fossil fuel outcompeted coal as opposed to the renewable sector, namely natural gas, has played a huge role in that in the United States. But we are also seeing, you know, solar and wind really pick up in this country and globally, as well as China has been really spearheading wind power internationally. And the writing is just on the wall. You know, I think that there's still going to be, you know, fossil fuels are going to be around as long as we'll permit them to be. And that's just underscoring the kinds of changes that need to be made at the local and federal level when it, through the act of voting.
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously you've given us a wealth of information, which has been fantastic. Where could people go to find out more about you and what you're doing?
Yeah, so I have a website. It's shahirmosri.com. You can also access it through roadforclimateaction.com. And importantly, a lot of the youth community is on Instagram. And actually, I'm very active on Instagram. So if you just go to dr.shahirmosri, that's the handle that you can search on Instagram. And I'm, like I said, very active there, always trying to encourage people to adopt eco-friendly sort of lifestyles. You'll see a lot of my urban farming that I do here in my backyard. And so those two sources, I think, are probably the best that come to mind. I should mention that I have a monthly newsletter. So that is something that I would encourage anybody who's interested in this topic to sign up on. And you could just do that by going to my website.
Okay, fantastic. If what we'll do is we'll put all the links to these on our show notes, if you're happy with that.
That'd be fantastic.
Not a problem. So understanding the climate emergency, what keeps you up at night?
I should say that what keeps me up at night is working on the climate emergency. I hardly sleep. So that's probably my most direct answer. But, to get at your question, I think that what I'm most concerned about is, you know, the positive feedback systems that we talked about, which are, you know, not in our control, and the extent to which those might kick into gear if we don't act quickly enough. I think that that really is the big X factor with climate change. And, you know, beyond that, I just really hope that we don't find ourselves where we were over the last 4 years, where we elect somebody again to the, you know, US to house, yeah, to the US presidency that is, you know, saying all this mumbo jumbo about climate being a hoax and pulling us out of the Paris Climate Accord. That to me would just be a devastating outcome that we could not see repeat itself. So I'd say those two things are the things that keep me up at night.
Yeah. Understood. So to turn it around and put a slightly more positive spin on it then, what makes you optimistic for the future?
What makes me optimistic about the future is the youth community and how much education and awareness there is within young people about climate change. I saw this firsthand giving a presentation to a group of sixth graders in Connecticut, where I opened up my first series of questions asking students to tell me, you know, do you think the earth is healthy or unhealthy right now? And one little boy raised his hand and he said, well, the earth is unhealthy because we're burning a bunch of coal and oil and gas, and it's releasing greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, which is heating up the planet. And I thought, well, there goes my whole presentation that I had planned. So, that was really encouraging just to see that level of education coming out of children. There's a famous lawsuit called Our Children's Trust that was 21 members of the youth community that were suing the U.S. Government basically for inaction on climate change. And that's just another example of our community, our youth community getting involved on the issue of climate change. Greta Thunberg is another example. Mm-hmm. They're just really leading this cause, just really rallying up the incoming generation, and the Sunrise Movement, just another example. So that's really, to me, the most positive thing that gives me hope, is that we're seeing this new, really passionate generation come into fore, and they're the ones that we're ultimately leaving this planet to, but also these are the ones who are also going to start occupying places in the, you know, judicial, or in the political system. So hopefully they'll help us bring about change when it comes to that. So
we're heading towards the end of the interview, and we don't want to miss information, important information that you might want to share. What question should we have asked but we didn't?
Oh, I think you guys did a great job of asking questions. I don't have anything that comes to mind. I think that the most important thing that I always like to pinpoint is that it's not too late to address climate change. You know, all the things that I said are sort of scary or overwhelming, especially when it comes to climate impacts and the future and this and that. But by no means is this a foregone conclusion. You know, we have still dramatically different paths that we can take forward, whether we go down the path of climate inaction or climate action. You know, the things such as sea level rise and temperature extremes, these all can be dramatically different if we decide to act today. So I think that's just one thing that I would say. And another thing is, although I encourage everyone to, you know, find my website and my newsletter and all that, there's a real importance to finding local climate organizations in your own area and not trying to combat this issue on your own by sort of reinventing the wheel. There's already a blueprint on effective climate outreach, climate education that is being practiced by organizations that have learned a lot over their existence that I think people can tap into. And it's always easier to stay encouraged when you're working with people who are in the same sort of effort as you are. So I would just highly recommend people tap into these resources such as, you know, Citizens Climate Lobby, which is an internationally climate reality project, 350.org. These are some organizations that, and there's probably others at the local level that I would encourage people to tap into and stay active with.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very, very much for your time and the information that you've given us. And like I said, we'll put everything on the show notes. And it's so good. We'd love to be able to keep in contact with all the other bits and pieces you're doing, and especially when your new book comes out, telling the stories as well. I think that would be absolutely fantastic to hear some of those. So thank you very much for being on the show.
Absolutely. Well, so thanks so much for having me. It's really been a privilege to be on a talk with you both. Thanks so much.
Not a problem.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So that was Shahir Masri, and what a wealth of information was in that podcast. I think we're going to need to spend some time and decipher and learn an awful lot of the information that he gave us. Mm.
A lot of the information from the podcast you will actually find in his book. You could go to his website to purchase the book directly. I think amongst the extra information that we've received and the amazing advice that we received from Shahir, one important thing to mention is starting conversations. That's one thing that we don't do besides the podcast. We don't usually talk to our friends about climate and climate action. And we try not to educate just because we don't want to impose on other people. But I think Shahir is right. It is time for us to start the conversation at the dinner table, start the conversation with our friends, with our colleagues at our workplace, and start getting involved in local climate action groups.
Absolutely. As ever, this show is funded by you, the listeners. So please help us. Go to our Patreon page, which are links on the show notes. And
the dog is interfering.
And
here.
The dog is interfering with everything today. You're going to say hello, Chloe.
Come and say hello.
Chloe tends to interrupt wherever she wants.
She's the third.
So this is Chloe.
She's the co-host.
The third host of the How to Be Good podcast. Anyway, as we said, it's a show that is specifically for you and funded by you. So if you'd like to go onto our Patreon site, that would be great. And follow us whenever you can. Dog. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook for more updates, and also for more updates on how we're getting on with the tree planting.
Indeed. Looking forward to the next one.
Take care. Stay safe. Bye-bye.
Bye.